Hello, and welcome to the Dr. Nurse Mama Show, prescribing hope for healthy families here on American Family Radio. Here's your host, Professor, Pediatric Nurse Practitioner, and Mom of Four, Dr. Jessica Peck.
Well, hello there, friends. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Listen, whatever you are doing, wherever you are going, you need to stop and you need to find a place to turn on the radio and listen. You are not going to want to miss a minute of today's powerful story. I have been looking forward to this for several weeks, ever since I've known this book was coming out, and I've known we have had this guest. And you're thinking, well, who is it, Jessica? Just tell us who it is. Well, I'm going to tell you, but I'm giving you a minute to get settled and to tune in and to really concentrate, because this story is so inspiring. We've got Molly Stillman. Now, she is the host of Can I Laugh on Your Shoulder, a podcast. She's a sought-after speaker, and she started a lifestyle blog in 2007 called Still Being Molly. That is a community for women who love ethical style, clean beauty, parenting, funny stories, serving in their communities, all kinds of things you can see on there. Her deep passion lies in inspiring women to know they were created on purpose, with a purpose, and for a purpose. Molly lives with her husband, John, her children, Lily and Amos, and various and sundry animals, and I'm quoting Molly, on a small farm in Durham, North Carolina. She loves Jesus a whole lot. She drinks too much Diet Coke, I'm with you on that one, and eats a lot of Chipotle burritos. And you can find her on the internet at Still Being Molly. And she has written a powerful memoir of her story, and it is If I Don't Laugh, I'll Cry. Molly, we're so happy to have you here on the show today.
I am honored to be here. Thank you so much for having me, Jessica.
Well, let's just dive right in. And, you know, I was reading in your book in the introduction, and you said, have you ever said something and immediately regretted it the moment the words left your mouth? Are you constantly worrying about whether the people in the room even like you? Do you often wonder if you're a bit much for people? And I know there are people out there listening who say, yes, that is me. Well, Molly is your people. And you start your story as my favorite kind of story in the history of ever. It is, but God. And that is amazing. And as you open your book, Molly, I'm just going to take us right to that moment. You start telling your story on your 21st birthday. I want you to take us to Christopher Newport University, where we find you as the president of the Student Government Association, belting out a Bring Down the House version of Killing Me Softly. I feel like I had to throw that in there before receiving a certified letter with a, okay, y'all listen to this, a $245,000 $245,485.74, because you said the 74 cents is really specific. So that, yeah, a check that dramatically changed the course of your life. Hello, Molly. My goodness. Take us to that moment. Let's start there, and then we'll work our way back.
Yeah, well, it was really important for me to start my memoir that way, because I really wanted people to enter into a story where you kind of start going, wait, what happened? How did they? I have so many questions.
Yes.
And then I had to take you, then after that, I take you back in time to really help kind of paint the picture of what led up to that moment. And so, yes, I drop you in on my life. It was my 21st birthday. It was like the second day of class at Christopher Newport in Newport News. And I was, by all intents and purposes, you know, I was killing it. I was president of the student body. I was in a sorority. I had a great boyfriend. I was, yes, singing Fuji's karaoke, and I was really at this great part of my life on the outside. But on the inside, I was dealing with some really intense grief. I lost my mom when I was a senior in high school. I was, and I just had never properly grieved. I was, you know, so I was battling a lot of things that I had never really shared with people. And there I am on my 21st birthday, and I get a call that there is a certified letter waiting for me in the campus mail room. And, you know, I'd never received a certified letter before. I didn't know what this was. And for the campus mail room, and I pick up this package and I open it up. And like you said, I mean, I opened it up, and yes, there was a paper check. It was like, you know, I still kind of laugh at the fact that it was a paper check for $245,485.74. And that was after taxes, by the way. I didn't have to pay taxes on that. And that was because it was a surprise inheritance from my mom's estranged family, which the story around that is obviously a little messy, a little complicated. But this was nothing that I was expecting to receive. So I was pretty blindsided. And, you know, what happens when you give a very emotionally mature and emotionally stable 21-year-old college senior a $250,000, Jessica?
My gosh.
It's a recipe for disaster. And, yeah. And so, yes, spoiler alert, less than 2 years later, I had not only spent every last dollar, but I was over $36,000 in consumer credit card debt. And so I'd blown it. I mean, I will say, I feel like I have to give myself some credit, okay? Because I beat myself up a lot about this. I'm healed on the other side of it for sure. But, you know, I did start a scholarship at my university in my mom's name. I gave some of it to my dad. I gave some of it to my sister. But then really beyond that, I didn't do a single responsible thing with it. And I had to learn a lot of really painful mistakes. And it's also really important to note, like, I was not walking with the Lord. I was not a follower of Jesus at the time. And in a lot of ways, it kind of pushed me even a little bit further, because all of a sudden I come into this windfall where I feel powerful. Money mm-hmm. can make somebody feel powerful, mm-hmm. and that's what I felt, and it really was a kiss of death.
But, you know, I look back at it, Molly, and I give you so much credit, because you say, you know, what any emotionally stable 21-year-old, well, first of all, there is no such thing, right? Their brains haven't even finished developing. And I think it's so interesting how we can come to this point of crisis in our lives, and it manifests itself through, you know, through yours, through spending, because before that, there were a lot of things about your life, Molly, that were just out of control. I mean, your mother was sick, and we'll talk about that. That was completely out of your control, but this money is something that you could control, and that feeling of power, and you describe it as dopamine hits, is really powerful, and it seems like good therapy at the time. Like we say, what is not good therapy is add to cart. Like, those are not good therapy words, right? But we use that. And I will give you a shout out here, because yes, you did create a scholarship for your mom, but you sold your Jeep to do it. And I thought that was pretty amazing, because you had made that commitment and then realized you didn't have the money, but then you sold your Jeep that, you know, you had bought first with the money, which I think is pretty incredible. But friends, the book is called If I Don't Laugh, I'll Cry: How Death, Debt, and Comedy Led to a Life of Faith, Farming, and Forgetting What I Came Into This Room For. So, Molly, on this show, we talk a lot about generational trauma, and that was evident in your life. And you just tell in a really hilarious and touching way about your parents, who recovering alcoholic Irish Catholic boy meets recovering alcoholic Irish Catholic girl. Tell us briefly about their stories and how they met and how, you know, you came into the world from that.
Yeah, their story was an incredibly winding, messy road. They met later in life. They were not their first marriages. My dad had gotten, you know, my dad was born the day before D-Day, for perspective. Like, he was born June 5th, 1944, the day before D-Day. His dad was, you know, literally in France and Germany during World War II, fighting while my dad was being born. And my mom was born in 47. So, you know, my dad is technically a silent generationer. He's not even part of the boomers. And my mom was a very, like, you know, an elder boomer. And so they met later in life. My dad had been married right out of college. That marriage had ended. He had gotten married a second time. That's where he had my sister. That marriage had ended, you know, due to alcoholism. And my dad got sober in July of 1979. And then my mom, you know, she had grown up in, you know, again, they both grew up in these Irish Catholic households. And they really were really wrestled with the church. My mom went to Catholic nursing school. She went to Mercy Hospital School of Nursing in Baltimore, Maryland. And in 1968, an Army recruiter came and was recruiting nurses to and go to Vietnam. And so my mom enlisted. She went to Vietnam. She was in Vietnam from 1969 and 1970. We can talk about more about that in a little bit. But, you know, she returned home from Vietnam. She gets married. That marriage ends, you know, a lot of it due to alcoholism, due to PTSD, just so many things. And so my parents met, you know, my dad had been sober for 4 years. My mom had only been sober for a year. And so they're later in life. They meet at an AA meeting, and they had kind of a funny first group outing where pretty quickly my mom fell in love with my dad's sense of humor. And next thing they know, they are going on their first date to Harper's Ferry. And my dad has his daughter, and he takes my mom. And they have this great day at Harper's Ferry, and they're walking back to the car, and they're holding hands. And my dad's smiling at my mom. And she says, "What?" And he says, "This is going to sound crazy, but you and I are going to get married, and we're going to have a little girl named Molly." This is their first date, Jessica. Okay,
that's awesome.
Like, talk about what? And my mom, of course, kind of at the moment was taken aback, but also said, "Okay." And next thing they know, my dad proposes on their second date in a Jewish delicatessen.
Of course.
And 6 weeks later, they were married. And then 10 months later, I was born. And so, you know, they meet in this very roundabout, whirlwind way. Mm-hmm. But they had this common ground of love for one another. They were, you know, on their own journeys of sobriety and their own spiritual journeys. And but they loved each other deeply. And I can say, you know, obviously I shared that my mom passed away. Mm-hmm. And I saw that until the day she died. You know, I don't know if I believe in soulmates or if people believe in soulmates, but if there is such a thing as soulmates, I believe that my parents were it. And because I saw that they lived out their marriage vows of for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, you know, in sickness and in health. And their marriage was put to the test almost immediately. In fact, I was talking with my dad about this the other day. Like, on paper, it really made no sense that their marriage worked. Because on paper, society would say that their marriage was doomed from the start. Mm-hmm. And they just, that was not their story in the end. And it really gave me, in a lot of ways, a picture of what a beautiful marriage really can look like. And that's a gift that that I do not take for granted.
It is really beautiful to see how each generation has its own healing and taking just those little steps towards intentionally healing from that trauma, and then looking at you and then your kids, which is just absolutely amazing to see the journey that happened. Yeah. And, you know, we're coming up on a break here, Molly, but when we come back, I really want to dive into your mom's journey as a nurse in Vietnam. I told you before we started that, you know, of course, I'm a nurse. And so I feel like this just kind of resonated with me differently. And so for our listeners, if you are a Vietnam War veteran or you know someone who is a Vietnam War veteran, you'll definitely want to stay and listen to this perspective. And it was so interesting to me to read your mom's perspective, because she talked a lot about the focus on men who are men veterans who were coming back. And of course, you know, a lot of them were treated very, very badly because of the public sentiment against the war. But as little as there was in the way of resources for men following Vietnam, there were even fewer for women. Yeah. And especially nurses. And reading about, you know, what she encountered just the most horrific things that you could ever possibly imagine. And yet she found resilience, even though when she came back and thought it was over, a new journey and a nightmare from Vietnam was just beginning. But God, Molly, but God. And I love that in the introduction of your book, you quote from Psalm 40, "I waited patiently for the Lord. He turned to me and heard my cry. He lifted me out of the slimy pit, out of the mud mud and the mire. He set my feet on a rock and gave me a firm place to stand. He put a new song in my mouth, a hymn of praise to our God. Many will see and fear the Lord and put their trust in him. And I know that's going to happen from your story. So when we come back, we'll talk about your mom's struggle in Vietnam and what happened afterwards that led to that inheritance. So don't go away. We'll be right back. Last year, because of you, Preborn's network of clinics saw over 58,000 babies saved. Thank you to all who made this possible. Let's celebrate these precious babies. Daisy and her husband had decided they never wanted kids. And when she found out she was pregnant, she immediately thought abortion. But after she and her husband met her baby on ultrasound and heard the heartbeat, their hearts melted and they chose life. Her baby Jeffrey is healthy and beautiful, and Daisy and her husband can't even imagine life without him. Each of these babies are truly miraculous, and every day, Preborn celebrates 200 miracles. $28 a month can be the difference between the life and death of a child. When a mother meets her baby on ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection that doubles a baby's chance at life. Let's join together and help mothers choose life. Just dial pound 250 and say the keyword baby. That's pound 250 baby, or visit preborn.com. That's preborn.com.
You're listening to the Dr. Nurse Mama Show with Dr. Jessica Peck on American Family Radio.
Well, welcome back, friends. You are walking into my conversation with Molly Stillman, who is, I'm pretty sure you're younger than me, Molly, and you've written a memoir. I think that's pretty amazing. You have lived a lot of life, and her book is coming out very soon. You should get it. It's called If I Don't Laugh, I'll Cry: How Death, Debt, and Comedy Led to a Life of Faith, Farming, and Forgetting What I Came Into This Room For. And Molly is giving away 3 copies of this book. Not 1, not 2, but 3 copies to the first 3 callers. You can call in at 888-589-8840. That's 888-589-8840. I know, Molly, my husband keeps trying to call in and win, and he can never be fast enough to win. So good luck, honey. I'm rooting for you right there. But we were just about to talk about Molly's mom, who was a nurse in Vietnam. And Molly, I would love for you just to share a little bit about how her experience and what happened when she came home and how that shaped her as a mom and then shaped you as her daughter.
Yes. So she was an Army nurse. She was part of the Army Nurse Corps in Vietnam from 1969 to 1970. So she served a little over a year. And primarily, she served at the 71st Evac, which was in Pleiku near the Cambodian border. And this was, if anybody knows anything about Vietnam War history, this was in a highly, highly active combat zone. And so she went to Vietnam, this young, idealistic American girl next door, fresh out of nursing school with patriotic colored glasses on. And very quickly, I remember she said that, her whole thought was, well, that if the boys were over there being blown apart, then somebody might needs to be over there to put them back together. And that was kind of the patriotic lens that she saw this through, is this was a duty to country and to her, fellow man. And very quickly when she was over there, she realized how wrong she was, of how brutal this actually was going to be. And the reality is that the war, war in general is bad. There's no one that would say that there is a good war. Mm-hmm. This war in particular was extremely bloody. It was extremely divisive. And there's a lot, especially there was a lot of propaganda around it. There was so much that was happening back home. Mm-hmm. And when my mom returned home, for perspective, she flew into Travis Air Force Base
And she joked that, you know, she gave the Army a year of her life, and the least they could have done was given her a ride to the airport.
Right.
But she, you know, she got to the Air Force Base, and they didn't even have, I mean, there was a transit strike. They didn't even give her a ride to San Francisco International Airport. And so she had to hitchhike in her Army fatigues with her bags, and she hitchhiked to San Francisco International Airport. But in the process, she was spit on. She was called a baby killer. There was feces thrown at her. She had vulgarities hurled at her. And that was an incredibly rude awakening for somebody who had just returned from war. There was no brass band. There was no signs, you know, welcome home signs or a parade. It was just vitriol from the moment she stepped off of that plane. And it continued. And the reality is that, you know, veterans returning home at that time were deemed baby killers, and they were not celebrated like we celebrate our military servicemen and women these days. But the even worse so was the treatment for female Vietnam veterans. There's not even an accurate estimation as to how many Vietnam veterans were women served in the war. It's estimated as probably around 11,000, but nobody really knows the exact number.
Mm-hmm.
And so there just weren't resources for veterans in general, but especially women veterans. I mean, she told me how she would go to the VA trying to get resources for literally anything and be turned away by the VA and told, you know, well, women didn't serve in Vietnam. And so that further fueled her suppressing of the war, repressing of the war. She battled alcoholism, severe PTSD, even though, you know, she didn't have a word for that.
Right.
And so her journey really was pretty wild. Fast forward, in 1983, not only, as I mentioned earlier, she got sober, but she published her memoir, Home Before Morning, which was the very first nonfiction account of the war from the perspective of a woman. And the book was incredibly divisive while also being incredibly healing for a lot of veterans. There was controversy all around it, you know, but it became a bestseller in 83. And in a lot of ways, it was her, she always kind of described it as her exorcism of the war from her mind and her spirit. And that was really important to her to also tell the story of these veterans. And so eventually the book became so divisive that, you know, there had been talks that it would get turned into a movie. Actually, Sally Field had optioned it briefly in the mid-80s to turn into a movie with Columbia Pictures, but the controversy around it was so thick that she pulled out. And then the show China Beach aired later in the 80s, starring Dana Delaney. And that was actually loosely based off of Home Before Morning. They kind of used that as the rubric,
inspiration,
but they changed enough they didn't have to give her any credit. And but I watched this woman. She just was a heavy advocate for veterans and women veterans especially. She was testifying before Congress. She was at the groundbreaking for the wall and the Vietnam Women's Memorial, and she was just a tireless advocate and a voice for those who so long had been silenced. And I watched, you know, as a kid, I watched her show me really what it was like to be a trailblazer in a lot of ways and to stand up for what she knew was right. Certainly there were other women alongside of her for sure. But I hear from a lot of people today that say that a lot of the just access to general women's health care through the VA and female veterans and a lot of the rights of women veterans is due in large part to the advocacy work that my mom did.
Oh, you've got to be so proud. I mean, and you know, honestly, Ollie, I looked up her book on Amazon the other day. Do you know the hardcover book sells for like $120? I mean, it is, that's pretty amazing. And just to see, you know, you growing up in the shadow of this, it's so interesting to see. And you have such a great sense of humor. And I think that's where your title comes from. Like, if I don't laugh, I'll cry. Because if you look at everything that happened, I mean, you experienced a lot of hardship. And then you're growing up, you know, like just being raised at pretty much as an only child, you know, when you're there in the home with your mom and your dad. And then when all of this starts to seem to get behind you, your mom gets sick. So what happened then?
Yeah. So it was the fall of 1994, and through a weird confluence of events, we were doing some remodeling in the home, which plays into all of this. I grew up in a really, really old home, and we're talking like horsehair insulation, dead birds in walls, all that kind of stuff. And when they were doing some renovations, the toxic dust got in my mom's lungs. And within 24 hours of that first day of demolition, my mom woke up in pulmonary edema. And you, as a nurse, I know that you are very familiar with that. And it was no joke. And she was rushed to the hospital in the ambulance. And she was placed on a ventilator. She was in ICU, and she was fighting for her life. And we then that day changed the course of our lives forever, because she then was thrust into a world of trying to figure out what in the world is going on. And we went to specialists at the Mayo Clinic, at Johns Hopkins, the VA hospital. And then months later, we actually pack up a motorhome and we drive across the country. I'm in fourth grade at the time, and we end up in Denver. And we are in Denver, Colorado, at the National Jewish Hospital for Respiratory and Immunological Disorders. Say that three times fast.
Especially when you're in fourth grade. I mean, come on.
I know. And they diagnosed her with an incredibly rare autoimmune collagen vascular disease, kind of a combination of things. A form of Wagner's disease or Werner's disease. Nobody really knows how it's pronounced. Yeah. And then polyangiitis with granulomatosis. And essentially, for the people who are like me and aren't nurses or doctors, essentially this combination of diseases, which was something that only about four other people in the world had ever been diagnosed with, was both a respiratory illness that essentially her lungs were suffocating her, and her joints and her, you know, the collagen was being eaten away, and her joints were being eaten away from the inside out. And so it was essentially a disease that was destroying her body from the inside out. And the prognosis is a maximum of 2 years to live. And so we then began to navigate this road of dealing with a chronically ill, I had a chronically ill mom. My dad had a chronically ill wife. They kept the diagnosis from me, as far as the prognosis, rather. And, because they really wanted to protect my childhood, in a lot of ways. And so, but they knew that every day that my mom woke up was a gift, because tomorrow was not guaranteed. Spoiler alert, my mom got 8 years instead of two. And and that led to eventually her passing away on November 15th, 2002. And so in a lot of ways, while it was to me, it was sudden. It was the middle of the night. It was unexpected. But for my dad and my mom, you know, they had had discussions about this for years, and they had had conversations about this for years. So my dad grieved for 8 years, whereas I was suddenly thrust into a season of grief. And so that just really catapulted me into just a whole different life, where I had to leave behind the life that I thought I was going to live, and the life, you know, now living without my mom.
Well, reading about your story, Molly, you know, you share in a really powerful way that, you had a fight with your mom the night before she died, and you talk about how the last thing she said to you was that she loves you. And now I'm sure you know, as a mom, and just reading about your mom and knowing that you were her life, you were her pride and joy, like you were everything to her. She poured so much love into you. You knew that she forgave you even the moment that those words left your mouth. Like, that's what we do as moms who love our kids and care about our kids. And but looking at this, and I think, you know, parents, I'm sure your parents did the best thing that they thought that they could at the time. And we make the best decisions that we can. And I look and see how much we've evolved as a society to talk about trauma and to talk about the ways that this impacts us. You said your dad was from the silent generation, which some people are probably saying, wait, what is it even that? You know, it's the generation between the boomers and the greatest generation. Those children were raised to be seen and not heard. Like, you don't talk about it. You just soldier on. That's what you do. And then even your mom developing PTSD and not knowing what that was. And you talk about, even as a teenager, you became her caretaker. And you talk about even you going to a concert once where she had an episode, and you just not even having any language or frame of reference to see what that was. And yet you responded. And so can you look back at that teenage Molly? And are you in a place now where you can give her grace to see that she did the best that she could with what she knew? Have you, how are you in that journey?
Absolutely. And a lot of that has come on the other side of walking with Jesus and really getting to a point where I am walking not only in the forgiveness that God gives, but the forgiveness that I had to give myself, which came much, much later. In fact, I accepted the forgiveness that God gave me when I got saved. And, but it was a much, much longer, messier journey to forgive myself for all the things that I had done. And yes, I love the way you said it. I absolutely give teenage Molly a whole lot of grace, especially now raising kids. And I have a daughter who's in the tween age, and you know, she is hot one minute and cold the next. And it is,
I do. I know those 13.
I don't know which one.
13 moods in 13 minutes is what I call it. Yeah.
Yeah, where just some days I'm like, I don't know who you are or what you have done with my child. And then the next minute, you know, it's, you know, she's right back.
I love you,
being,
mommy.
Yes, exactly. And so, and I look back and I'm like, that was me. That was me. And my dad jokes and he says, like, you're just getting payback. Like, it's just Molly 2.0. so we laugh about it. But yeah, you know, it just, it really was about giving myself forgiving myself for who I was then and the decisions that I made at that time, because I didn't know any better. And really on the other side of it, if I had to get to a point where I was able to look back and say, you know, I did what I did at the time because that was the phase of life that I was in. And if I didn't do that, then I wouldn't have learned the lessons. You know, I think about it as a mom now, like when I talk with my kids and I say, if you don't make mistakes, you'll never learn, you'll never grow. And so it's so important to give ourselves that space to make mistakes in a safe environment that are hopefully not life-altering mistakes, but
I agree,
nonetheless, so that we can grow.
It's so true, Molly. Well, when we come back, I really want to dive into your faith journey because, yes, all of these things that you faced were so difficult, but God is the most important part of your story. And when we come back, we'll dive into that and talk about how God changed your life.
Podcasts of the Dr. Nurse Mama Show are available on the podcast page at AFR.net. Now, back to Dr. Jessica Peck on American Family Radio.
Welcome back, friends. We are talking to Molly Stillman about her very powerful memoir that comes out next week. It's called If I Don't Laugh, I'll Cry: How Death, Debt, and Comedy Led to a Life of Faith, Farming, and Forgetting What I Came Into This Room For. And let me tell you, Molly is just absolutely hilarious. I have read the book. I read An Advanced Coffee. I told Molly, I laughed, I cried. It was definitely better than Cats. Cats is a low bar, but you know, it was so good, Molly, just to see how God can still work in the midst of things that seem really terrible. And so going through, you know, your parents' history of having previous marriages, struggling with alcoholism, your mom going to Vietnam, and then being sick from what you later found out was Agent Orange. That was really what caused her to be sick. And then losing her while you were in high school, inheriting $250,000, and then losing it because you were 21. And Molly, I want to go back to that moment you walked into the bank. And for any bank workers out there, I'm not throwing any judgment at you, but just maybe you can learn something from Molly's story to say, if a 21-year-old walks in with $250,000 check, they're probably going to need some help. So take us there, Molly.
Yes.
I mean, I was reading that thinking, no yes. way. I wanted to run in and help you, but I couldn't have helped you then. I couldn't have helped you. I didn't know anything.
I know. Which, by the way, quick side note, I'm really glad that you did mention the fact that, yeah, her disease was related to her exposure to Agent Orange. I realize I forgot to mention that. And that's obviously a huge portion of, mm-hmm. of this story is the effects of Vietnam affecting us even all these decades later. And that, right. You know, war changes us forever. And sometimes that takes its form in illnesses. So I did receive this inheritance. And you know, one of the questions I get a lot of is, well, like, what did you do logistically? You get a check for $250,000. What do you do? And I'm like, that's a great question. Cause I also didn't know what to do. And
you
so,
went to class.
I went
with the
class,
check in your backpack,
the check in my backpack. And I, you know, for sure couldn't focus. But it was like the second day of class in college. So I was like, I can't miss class. And so I went and then after that I went to the bank, and because I was like, I don't know where to go. And so I went to the bank and I walk up to the teller, like the you know, the regular bank teller. And I show her this check and she looks at me like I am insane, and then proceeds to tell me to go talk to a guy, you know, one of the desk bankers. And, you know, and yeah, the reality is that, I never really got any guidance. And so, you know, again, I own the mistakes that I made financially, but I do look back and I go, how did not a single person in that bank go, maybe you should speak to a financial advisor? Like, maybe you should get some financial counseling. Because really on the fundamental level, like he was just kind of like, yeah, you put it in some of it in this savings account and like put it in some CDs and, you know, and then the rest just stayed in the bank, and which is just incredibly unwise. I went down a pattern of just incredibly reckless spending where I was just, you know, I went and I bought a $40,000 brand new Jeep, and then I flew my boyfriend and I on, you know, first class to Rome for spring break, and I went to New York and I was taking comedy classes, and I was just left and right. And for me, you know, alcohol and drugs was not a problem for me. That was just not something that I had had an issue with. I think especially, you know, growing up the child mm-hmm. of recovering alcoholics,
right.
I didn't want to touch
you
drugs
know.
With a 10-foot pole, and I was incredibly responsible when it came to alcohol use. And so it was not something that I was worried about. But for me, like a coping mechanism became spending money, and it became not dealing with my pain. And instead the dopamine hits that I would get, the adrenaline rush I would get of buying something. And that doesn't, you know, that's not very like an attractive story, you know what I mean? But the reality is that once I started to share this with people after the fact is, it's a more common problem than people really want to talk about is financial recklessness and using money, you know, as a almost like a grasp for power. And so, yeah, it sent me down, it escalated my journey towards rock bottom.
And you know what I admire about you, Molly, is that you're so transparent about it. And there is so much power in truth and transparency and just sharing your struggles and saying, yes, this was my struggle. And so much of the emotional turmoil comes from the secretiveness of that. And you talk about that in your book, how, you know, you are trying to manage your money and like, okay, I'll go on the taco night where they're like a dollar, you know, so that nobody, I can still go, but nobody knows I have money trouble because money trouble is socially shameful. And in all of this, Molly, you know, your faith journey as a child was complicated because your parents had a complicated relationship with their faith and their church. And you talk even about how your mom took you occasionally to a Black church, you know, that you went to worship at. But and then you had a friend who took you to church, but then rejected you because you weren't Christian enough. And you become the lead singer of a band called Doubting Thomas, which I think was hilarious. Like you're the lead singer in a yeah. Christian band. But, you know, there's one point in your story, Molly, that really got me. And it was you were rock bottom. You called a credit counseling company. You're trying to figure out what to do, really all on your own. And there's this lady named, you called Debbie from New Jersey. I don't know if it's because my husband's from New Jersey. So I just have like, you know, a special affinity for that. But she did something very unexpected, and that planted a seed of faith in your heart. And I hope that you see, you know, Molly, in your journey, that God's hand guiding you all along and planting those seeds, that this was a particularly meaningful one. Tell us about that, and then how your journey went from there until you met Jesus.
Yeah. You know, that, yeah. So I'd hit a financial rock bottom point in June of 2008. So less than 2 years after receiving the inheritance, and I was, you know, tens of thousands of dollars in debt, and I was a high school teacher making $30,000 a year, and I couldn't make the minimum payments on my credit cards. I had overdrafted my account again, and in a moment of desperation, I'm having a panic attack on the floor of my room, and in a moment of desperation, I call my bank. Because it was kind of one of these things where, if I'm being really, really just candid here, I realized that I had one of two choices. I had to either like figure out a way out of this, or I was going to take my own life. And I didn't see another way out of it. I felt so lost and hopeless and ashamed and embarrassed. And I couldn't bother to reach out to anybody and ask for help. And so I called a stranger and I called the bank. And what I got on the other line was a gift. I really believe she was an angel. I've never been able to like personally thank her, but I got compassion. She heard the panic in my voice, and eventually I got connected with a consumer credit card counselor organization, and I got a second angel on the phone, and that was Debbie. And when I say, you know, I was on the phone for probably a cumulative time of about 5 hours that day, where we were going through all of my bills, all of, you know, she was on the phone with these creditors trying to negotiate these interest rates and help me get into a journey where I could actually start to work towards paying off all this debt. But she left me with two things. One, she left me with a plan, and she said, you know, it's going to take work, but you can do this. You can get out of this debt. And then she, before we got off the phone, and this was not a Christian organization, Jessica, and she said, can I pray for you? And it's not like I was not walking with God, but I, at that moment, I was like, yes, you can. So she prayed for me, and I will never forget that. And so while it still took another 2 years to come to faith, God takes his time. And so I then eventually moved to North Carolina from Virginia. I was working four jobs, trying to make ends meet. I had gotten out of a really, really painful and unhealthy relationship. And I was at another rock bottom point. You know, I thought that point in June of 2008 was rock bottom, but it was not. It was just the first of a few rock bottoms. But eventually I had to get to actual rock bottom. And what I mean by that is the point at which I realized I could no longer do this on my own, that I had spent so many years trying to pull myself up by metaphorical bootstraps, trying to get myself out of the mess that I'd made. And I was thinking, you know, this is my fault. So I've got to get myself. I saw myself as the hero of my story. And I realized that I had lost all hope. And anytime you are striving by the world's standards, that is exhausting. And so I got to a point where I was desperate. And so I was at that point again, where I was either like, I've got to find hope, or I'm going to leave this world. And kind of fast forward, I had been hanging out with, spoiler alert, he's now my husband, but, you know, we became friends, a guy that I worked with. I didn't want a relationship. I was not ready for a relationship, but he was a Christian. And so meeting him and seeing his steadfastness and his identity being so secure in Christ. And mm-hmm. I just kind of was prompted one day, and I said, hey, can I go to church with you? And he said, yes, of course. And so I went to church with him September 26, 2010. And I heard the gospel for the first time, where I really grasped that there was a God in heaven who loved me and sent his son to earth to forgive me, to die for my sins and to forgive me, and that there was hope, and that there was an opportunity for me to actually find hope and live a life of hope. And so the next Sunday I went to church, and the next Sunday I went to church, and the next Sunday I went to church. And then I felt convicted to start tithing. And, you know, I was in debt, Jessica. Like, tithing made no financial sense. Like, I could barely buy food. So how was I going to start tithing? But it was, what it was not that I was like, I felt like I was obligated. It was out of obedience and surrender and unclenching the things that I had clenched for so long. And so I started tithing, and God just really began working in my life and healing so many things that were broken, and really showing me what it looks like to fully surrender every area of my life to him. And so that was in 2010. My husband and I got married in 2012. And you know, I want to say the rest is history, because I'm still living in it. It really was the catalyst for me being on a journey and with God that is beautiful and painful and hard. But I wouldn't change it for the world, because, you know, when you give hope to a hopeless person, like, that's an incredibly powerful thing.
It absolutely is. And I want to know, Molly, how has writing your story, you know, going back, there were several points in the book where you would say, you know, I really didn't even process this or think about this until I was writing it. And then you could see it, and you saw the tapestry, really, that God was weaving with all of those pieces together. I mean, that's amazing to me, because you went from, you know, kind of poor to rich to very poor to a journey of God calling you to himself and learning to trust God with your money. And then, I mean, we haven't even scratched the surface on some of the other things you've done. You've worked in the governor's office, you were in the radio. I mean, all of these things, you look back but see that God is in every moment of that. And your farm is now called Selah, which has, you know, just special meaning for that. I want to know, Molly, how has this changed you as a mom, as you share your history, your legacy with your kids, and how has that impacted your journey as a mother?
Absolutely. You know, I am able to, I have a grace for my kids in a lot of ways, but I approach, you know, really mothering my children in a unique way that people that maybe either grew up in the church their whole lives maybe don't necessarily have that perspective, whereas I kind of have the BC, the before Christ and the after Christ perspective of things, where there are times where I can have conversations with my kids and I can look at them honestly and say, hey, I don't have the answer for this. I don't know, but let's figure it out together. Or creating a space in which I say, hey, I am your safe person to ask questions. So if you have questions about something and you don't understand something, like, I want you to come to me and we're going to talk about it. And I, you know, obviously on their level, my kids are 10 and 8. On their level, I try to approach it from what's age appropriate for them to know about my story. And I tell them, you know, bits and pieces here. But I also don't want to hide things. And so I talk about, you know, the fact that I made a lot of mistakes. And I walked for many years without knowing the Lord. And I'm really thankful that I have two kids who love Jesus. And I know that I can't control what happens next. And I pray that they walk with him their whole lives. But in a lot of ways, like, when I falter and when I fail as a parent, which is often, Jessica,
yes, amen.
Often, when I falter, when I fail, I can always point them back to the one who will never fail them. And we talk a lot about that. And, you know, and I let them know, like, I make mistakes. And so when they do make mistakes, you know, because they're kids,
yeah,
I say, it's okay. Like, on the other side of it, like, God is good and he loved us and he is with us. And
God is good. He does love us. He is with us. And the book is called If I Don't Laugh, I'll Cry: How Death, Debt, and Comedy Led to a Life of Faith, Farming, and Forgetting What I Came Into This Room For. I could not put it down. Find Molly at stillbeingmolly.com. And we'll see you next time, friends. God bless.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.